England's Dreaming. Section 2. The Dream. The England in which I grew up in the 1970s was ill at ease with itself. It was the England of the winter of discontent, three-day weeks, power cuts and stagflation. It was a country of ugly concrete precincts, man-made fibres and the end of empire. Two types of people stand out in my memory. If you were an 8-year-old boy of my age, and you got on a bus in your school uniform and dared to stand on that bus all flushed with youth, some elderly man in beige clothing from J. Alfred Dunn would bark at you, "I fought in two world wars for the likes of you." Theirs was a country of Edwardian values in which Britain was great. The other type of person who sticks in my mind was the Mohican sporting punk who swaggered around the precincts, terrifying the former type of person simply by reason of having green hair 2 feet high. The terror this person embodied was the end of deference, the end of the Edwardian certainties, a symbol of the end of everything that many of the English considered to be great about them and about their nation. The former person is known now as a Little Englander. The latter is closer to D.H. Lawrence's England, My England, a very dark short story. The Little Englander's self-identity is best expressed by P.G. Wodehouse in this fragment. I quote, "There is a cosy fire in the study, and outside the wind is whistling. The ivy clusters thickly round the old grey stones. The king is on his throne, and the pound is worth a pound. Over in Europe, the comic foreigners are jabbering and gesticulating, but the grim grey battleships of the British fleet are steaming up the channel. Meanwhile, we are settling down to a tremendous tea of sausages, sardines, crumpets, potted meat, jam and doughnuts. Everything is safe, solid and unquestionable. Everything will be the same for ever and ever." Now, bound up with this Englander's sense of self is also a sense of English law. As George Orwell put it in The Lion and the Unicorn, Socialism and the English Genius, here one comes upon an all-important English trait, the respect for constitutionalism and legality, the belief in the law as something above the state and above the individual, something which is cruel and stupid, of course, but at any rate incorruptible. It is not that anyone imagines the law to be just. Everyone knows that there is one law for the rich and another for the poor. But no one accepts the implications of this. Everyone takes it for granted that the law, such as it is, will be respected and feels a sense of outrage when it is not. Now, within this affection for English law is a particular affection for equity as well, Dickens's Bleak House notwithstanding. Professor Roger Scruton, a sort of walking, talking Daily Telegraph editorial, sees equity, especially the collected works of Lord Denning, as an integral part of what it means to be English. And Professor Scruton's words, "The legal system is of an admirable simplicity, embodying a vision of law that did not merely distinguish England and its colonies from almost all other countries in the world, except those like the Scandinavian kingdoms, which had arisen from the same mysterious beginnings, but provided a paradigm of natural justice. It has begun to sink at last under the weight of centralised legislation, the bureaucratic law of the European Commission, and the politicised judgments of the European courts. But it has remained, until our day, the noble aspiration which had always guided it, namely to do justice in the individual case, regardless of the interests of power." And that from Scruton's England and Elegy. The idea that the common law system is simple, in Scruton's words, may strike any student of law as an odd one. And the reference to the English, and oddly, not British, colonies may strike one as being from another age. The reference also to, quote, mysterious beginnings is bound up with an English affection for Stonehenge, the legend of King Arthur, and the rumour that Jesus once visited Glastonbury. The reference to the Scandinavian kingdoms is a reference to the Viking heritage which the English love to claim for themselves. In common with the Romans, Angles and Saxons, an injection of Viking blood is thought to be an excellent thing. Now, given the English's caricatured distrust of foreigners, this may seem strange. However, the motto seems to be, if you can beat us, you can join us. Scruton laments the loss of an England in which the English are attached to the land. and shies away from an England which is in any sense modern. He seems, as Fry and Laurie once put it, to be in love with creamy old England. Ironically enough, he now teaches in Virginia. Indeed, even the great Professor Maitland, Downing Professor of Law at the University of Cambridge, considered there was not only something great about equity, but also that there was something quintessentially English about it. As Professor Maitland put it in his posthumously published lectures, "I don't myself believe that the use came to us as a foreign thing. I don't believe that there is anything Roman about it." And when we come to talk about the Roman influence of restitution in a later session, this assertion of equity's Englishness will be important. For me, England is less the green and pleasant land in which Blake expected Jerusalem to be builded, and more Morrissey's rain falling hard on a humdrum town, or, in London, Robert Smith's living with desertion and 8 million people. A disaffection with the Victorian and Edwardian hagiography of England, with the dream of England, has of course been a staple of some of the best English literature of the 20th century, from E.M. Forster, D.H. Lawrence and so on. My concern is that this mooted affection for law and for constitutionalism, part of the dream of what England is, overlooks the very real social problems of which English law is a part. And this will lead us into the second part of the dream of English law. It is a dream harboured by the legal positivists that law is rational, that law should be entirely predictable, and that law should be subjected to a rigid taxonomy. The architectural designs for my building in this lecture will require that the dream of rigidity is not recognised as the only way to construct a legal system. There are two aspects of rationality in this area of property law which I'm going to consider by way of example. I'll focus first on the theory of restitution of unjust enrichment, and then I'll focus secondly on the speech of Lord Bridge in Lloyds Bank and Rosset. But before we move on to that section of the lecture, let's just begin at the beginning. Laws are simply things which have been said, and which have acquired the authority and legitimacy of law because of the manner in which they were said. There is nothing immutable nor innate about the detailed content of our laws. They could be different. They could be unsaid. With that in mind, we can re-examine the culture of, for today's purposes, our private law and particularly our property law. One of the key aspects of our legal culture, I would suggest, is an assumption in its rationality. This is a part of its mythology. It is a key part of the dreaming I allude to in the title of this lecture. The key zone of debate between the legal positivists and the natural lawyers is a difference of opinion, almost an attitudinal difference, as to their respective preferences for order or for fairness as the principal quality of their ideal legal system. So we're either taking a preference for order, or on the other hand, we could be taking a preference for fairness. It's also, I would suggest, the key unspoken distinction between supporters of traditional equity on the one hand and supporters of a putative theory of restitution of unjust enrichment on the other. There are also two kinds of legal positivism, it seems to me, even if you're going to just take the positivist line. First, there is the determination to create models on which the law should be based, to hem in the law with taxonomies, as scientists would describe them. Professor Hart did this conceptually in The Concept of the Law, and Professor Burks and his acolytes have been attempting to do this with the Restitution Research Resource and similar publications. Secondly, there is that sort of positivism which dreams that order can be achieved through law. See, for example, the terror legislation in recent years, and historically the Black Act discussed by E.P. Thompson in his book Whigs and Hunters. But let's focus on the former type of positivism. Before I begin the construction of my building, I think I need to clear some of the rubble out of the way. In that sense, I refer, of course, to the theory of restitution of unjust enrichment, which I'll come to in the next part of this lecture.